Dark Journalist Special Feature. An in-depth discussion that goes where no one has gone before. A tale of two civilizations. With former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Catherine Austin Fitz. Now, let's go join Dark Journalist Daniel List.
Catherine, it's great to have you back for part three of our deep discussion on these two civilizations existing side by side. Now, in the first two episodes, we've looked at the geopolitical tensions that are happening, like the situation in North Korea, for example, and a lot of war talk is happening there. But we've also talked about the pressure domestically of the deep state trying to seize control of our political process here in America. But it seems over and over again we're confronted with this choice of a human versus inhuman civilization and future. Even in the deep divisions over the current budget process, we're seeing a lot of that go down in Washington.
You know, this is why centralized systems don't work. And I really saw it in Washington because I was running a small agency. We were about 7,000 people at the FHA.
Right.
And you would see the centralized leadership try and come up with a plan. And it was really funny because they'd come up with a plan and I'd say, okay, I'm going to subject this to, you know, an open discussion process with all the different constituencies. And they'd say, oh no, we got it all figured out. It's all perfect. It works. You know, we've vetted it. Da, da, da. I'd say, look, just bear with me. I just, want to do it. And we would literally take it and we would have these open meetings and you'd go through all the constituencies. And by the time it was over, they were like a little piddle of, oil on the floor. because there were a million things that hadn't been thought of.
Sure.
And we'd go through the process and then we'd reinvent it. And ultimately it would come out, it would come out just fine. We would get there. But who was it who said no one is as smart as all of us? That's why markets work.
Yes.
Because you need that group intelligence to work. And, I learned a lot. Our company got hired on competitive bid by FHA after I left and started Hamilton to do the HUD loan sales. And the way we did it, we did $10 billion of loan sales. They were wildly successful financially, and they were wildly successful for the taxpayers, not necessarily for the real estate developers feeding off the trough, of which Harvard Endowment was the number one. What we did was we did an open source design online with every constituent who was affected was in the room for the design. And then the design book was published openly and commented on and negotiated. And you literally ended up with a 2,000-page design book that was so detailed that I could bring in 10 smart college kids and they could do a billion-dollar loan sale. Just follow the design book. Mm. And it was amazing. But it created an enormous understanding among hundreds of different parties who had to affect a $1 billion transaction. And so the thing worked like a hot knife through butter because we were able to get the group intelligence going. And that's what you see happening. You know, we're trying to press everybody into what Joseph Farrell calls this one-track mind.
Mm-hmm.
You can't deal with a complex world. And you need... you need open source systems or you need markets to get that group intelligence working. And that's why I've always said, the solution to the central banking warfare model is if you look at the wealth on planet Earth today, it's 1% of what it could be because things are so controlled and centralized and mind controlled. If you could really let markets work, wow, the wealth is incredible. And so there's wealth enough for two civilizations. There's wealth enough for three civilizations. But you have to have transparency. And I think the leadership rightly feels, there may be enough money for three civilizations, but it may not be us who's in charge when it's all said and done.
True.
they don't want to be subject to meritocracy.
Oh, there's just no question about
right.
it. That is fascinating. Well, I sometimes think about your time at HUD, when it pops up in the news that they're having a new issue. And you've talked a lot about Jack Kemp, who was your boss at HUD and a major Republican operator, vice presidential candidate in 1996, et cetera, and how he was infinitely blackmailable and therefore willing to go outside the law. And now we have Paul Ryan, who was really his protege, his backbencher intern who learned the ropes from Kemp and what that means. So now, you know, we have Carson over at HUD, and he's finding $300 billion in fraud in his first week.
No, $500 billion. Well, he didn't find it. The inspector general had a report.
Okay.
Yeah, so HUD has always been one of the agencies with extraordinary undocumentable adjustments.
Right.
So let's step back and look at it very simply. The federal government is in complete violation and has been for decades of the rules in the Constitution regarding financial management. So the Constitution says all spending has to be envisioned by an appropriation. Mm-hmm. Okay, government in complete violation. Government is in complete violation of the financial management laws that say you have to have financial statements. So, for example, if you're a publicly traded company, like all the publicly traded companies that run the information and payment systems and bank accounts for the U.S. government, if you didn't produce your audited financial statements as required by, you know, the exchange would throw you off. You couldn't raise money in the capital markets. Your bank wouldn't affect transactions unless it was J.P. Morgan Chase and it was an inside deal like Madoff. So, you know, you wouldn't be allowed to function. And yet the U.S. government is the largest securities issuer in the world. They're allowed to function every day in the markets, despite the fact they're in violation of all the laws.
Hmm.
Okay. Now, what we know is since fiscal 1998, we've had extraordinary amounts of undocumentable adjustments. So let me explain what an undocumentable adjustment is. Let's say you got a bank statement. Your checkbook says you've been keeping a checkbook and you've been keeping a register, and your checkbook says I have $1,000 in my bank. And you get a statement from the bank and says you have $100 in the bank. And you say, oh, well, I'm going to write an entry in my checkbook that says undocumentable adjustment $900, $100 in my bank, and now we balance, right? That's an undocumented adjustment.
All right, but where did that $900 go?
Oh, Daniel, details. So, for example, last year, the Department of Defense's budget, I think, was about $600 billion. They had $6.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments.
Wow.
Okay. So imagine, let's say last year you made $100,000, but you had in your checkbook undocumentable adjustments of $1 million, 10 times your total revenues for the year. And somebody said, wait a minute. You know, you have undocumentable adjustments of 10 times your total revenues for the year. You'd say, that's just accounting adjustments. Don't worry. And they said, well, can I see your financial statements? He said, no, I can't produce them. Don't worry. What would you say?
Wow.
Exactly.
Zero accountability. So, yeah.
It's worse than zero accountability. We're back to how do you do the accounting for financing two civilizations from one without admitting that there are two civilizations.
Yeah.
You know. Now, remember, HUD is not a housing agency. HUD is the largest mortgage insurance operation in the world. So you have both FHA and Ginnie Mae and all sorts of connections to Freddie and Fannie.
Okay. Okay?
So you're talking about the biggest player in the global mortgage markets. And the fraud, at least from what I have seen and experienced, is beyond the pale. Because the question to people always say, you know, who say, oh, well, this is just accounting adjustments, is how could the Department of Defense lose 10 times or more its annual budget? Well, with securities fraud, you can.
Definitely.
With securities fraud, you can lose a near infinite amount of money every year, no matter what your budget is. Now, what is HUD? HUD is a huge securities operation, or it's financing the insurance for huge securities operation. HUD is run by the New York Fed member banks and the big defense contractors.
Mm-hmm.
They control. So, and all indications, remember, and the bailouts, when the bailouts hit, we had $27 trillion of bailouts when $8 trillion would have paid off all the single family mortgages in the country at that time.
Wow.
Right. So
it's not a pretty picture.
how can you have how can you lose $27 trillion on mortgage losses on a housing bubble when one third of that amount of money would pay off all the mortgages in the country?
It really makes no sense.
See, this is why I love math. You know, it helps you see things whole.
Yeah. Oh, it makes a huge difference.
There's a real story at HUD, and it's going to be interesting because if you're Ben Carson, right now you're overseeing a whole group of neighborhood operations that are basically used to bring drugs in and launder the money.
Right.
Okay. So now if you're going to change that model, you've got to go to the New York Fed member banks, the big defense contractors. You've got to go to Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohen and Mike Pompeo over at the CIA and the NSA. So you've got to go across government and say, are we prepared to turn the model and how? You know, and you've also got to pull Warren Buffett and private guys in too. You know, how are we going to turn the model?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to get them all on board for the plan. Well, how are you going to do that?
Well, that's interesting because if you have these guys and you've called them Titanic turners, now let's say they've been in office a couple months. What do you think their chances are now of being able to pull off a Titanic turn, roughly?
Well, here's the thing. My guess is that if we were to, you know, sort of go give a truth serum drug to Gary Cohen and Wilbur Ross and sort of the money guys who've come in, they would have their head in their hands saying, what have I done?
Yeah.
What have I done? You know, I put my reputation and my fortune at risk to come in and try and turn this machinery. And what have I done? So, you know, and in fact, what I would say to them is if you can get that cabinet off in a room, really talking and trusting to each other. This is why I think leadership is so important. If you can do that, you know, then you can get a lot of things done. If you can't, if teamwork breaks down, then we run the risk that everybody turns into a piggy or a security cat for themselves. That's my concern. So, I'm hoping these guys stick in and try and stay Titanic turners. What it depends on is it's going to depend on the general population taking responsibility and helping. So, you know, right now we see a population that's very divided, and the divide and conquer tactics of the corporate media and the intelligence agencies have been off the charts.
Oh, yeah.
And I think now is the time, and I'm hoping the budget process can facilitate this when we all have to get down and just look at the math. Because it's all going to come down to the mathematics of time and money. And the question is, how are we going to change? So, and the big 800-pound gorilla in the room is, you know, we're financing, you know, Papa has two families who don't know the other exists.
Exactly.
So, or one knows the other exists, one doesn't know the other exists. So how, and that's, you know, I think if you asked Wilbur Ross or Gary Cohen how they're going to deal with that, they would say that's above their pay grade.
Yeah.
So we get back to the big question of who's Mr. Global and why is Mr. Global behaving the way they're behaving?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Mr. Global. I was just about to bring him into the conversation. And I guess, you know, with everything that's going on with the Trump election and all the populism that we're seeing going on generally with Brexit, and in France also, how is Mr. Global doing?
My guess is Mr. Global is very frustrated.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
We saw Rothschild gave an interview where he didn't come out and promote the ConCon, but he said the American governance process is unmanageable.
Hmm.
And, you know, what a subscriber sent it to me and said, this is Rothschild promoting the ConCon. And here's the reality. If you look at what the American establishment has done to manage the general population, you know, divide and conquer, global spraying, vaccines, fluoride, you know, we are being, you know, we are under chemical, financial, legal assault. And then we behave in dysfunctional ways. And the establishment says, what an unattractive group of people. You know, so you have this cycle of disrespect. And And so I was hoping the Trump effort would help reverse the cycle of disrespect. I think that's the question. How do we reverse the cycle of disrespect and get back to doing something, get back together towards working towards a human society? When I, the rare moments that I go into establishment groups, I find the majority of people keenly interested in trying to see this go towards a human place, but they don't know how to get it there. And I don't see a way of getting it there without having honest conversations and engaging. You know, what I would do if I was Trump is I would, I used to love to play the old video games like, what was the Railroad Tycoon or Sim City. You know, I would basically put a Sim City simulation of the federal budget online and engage the 10% of the population that really want to be engaged, sort of that leadership group in, okay, what would you do and how would you do it? And let's hold everybody to the transparency within the ecosystem of healthcare. You know, so I would start to engage with the population in very detailed, substantive ways. I don't know if you saw it. Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz did a great debate about healthcare on CNN.
Yes.
After the inauguration. And it was great because people were really digging in and talking about the issues. And I thought, and apparently it got great ratings. So the time has come to start diving into the substance and diving into the numbers and engaging the group intelligence. And that's what has to happen. It's not going to happen if everybody's busy having wars.
That's the problem.
You know, the war turns the shriek meter back on and stops that group intelligence from happening.
Right, right. Ideas don't get out. One aspect of what Trump ran on was the border wall and this whole idea about immigration bans for certain types of individuals from terrorist countries and things like that. But the border with Mexico, and I have a funny story about the border, by the way, but how is it, you know, what's the real secret behind, say, Congress not being interested in border security?
Well, I think Congress, you have different groups, but the Democrats have been interested. If you look at a map of the country, and this is what I described in Productivity Backlash, the Democrats have basically become the party of Hollywood, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, and Washington. So you have four large metropolises that basically are the leaders in doing things with invisible assets. You know, they don't do the concrete things. They don't do the oil. They don't do the agriculture. They don't do, you know, it's the heartland that does the concrete things. They do the sort of abstract intellectual assets. And basically the challenge for those constituencies is how do we win within the Electoral College? And the way you do that is you bring in lots of immigrants and you put them around. So when I was working as the lead financial advisor during the Clinton administration, one of the senior Clinton officials who's very part of the Clinton group said to me, oh, well, we've given up on black people. We're moving them out. We're going to move Hispanics in. So there was a real plan to, you know, you're going to round up the blacks and put them in prison or do a variety of things that accelerates their or decreases their life expectancy. And you're going to pull in Hispanics to really repopulate that part of the urban areas. Mm-hmm. And that was a plan in the Clinton administration. And, but you were going to strategically position them so that between them and the guys who get government checks are going to basically make it possible for you to win the White House and basically control through the Electoral College. So that was the Democrats' plan. If you look at the Republican side, you have all these different industries that need cheap labor.
Okay.
And both of them are concerned about demographics. So whether it's the Democrats who want to rig the voting, or you have the sort of people worried about demographics or the Republicans who worry about farm labor, you know, various things like that. You know, the immigrants are a real, particularly from Latin America, real economic juggernaut. Now, I also have one other question, which was, we saw an enormous flood of immigrants over the last couple of years, young people coming throughout Latin America, clearly financed to move up. And then a lot of them, once they get to this country, kind of disappearing. And the, my big question was how many were going into the underground bases?
Well, in this tale of two civilizations that were unwinding here, they could constitute the labor force for that other civilization. It's possible.
Well, that's my concern. So, you know, so was the, you know, was all the immigrants things related to the first civilization, or was it also second civilization? If you look at how many people coming into the areas where you have big underground bases, it was certainly suspicious.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there's a strange thing about, you know, all this incredibly kind of hostile, invasive security at airports, but then leaving your border wide open, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, I've always believed the airports were, you know, the security system of the airports were a variety of things, one of which was running a feedback loop on shipping people. So I once had a very senior guy who'd left the CIA tell me that part of Global Spring, the nanoparticles, were to create organic bar chips. And I always thought those big screeners at the airport was part of checking and calibrating that system of chipping everybody basically with an organic chip.
Wow. Well, that is something to consider, but it really would explain a lot.
Well, you want to get depressed? One of the most depressing things, for during the early 90s, they started to redesign all the airports and turn them into shopping malls. And I was watching and thinking, how are they going to get people to shop at the airports? It doesn't make any sense. You know, and this went on for years, and then 9/11 hit, and suddenly the rule was you got to spend 2 hours at the airport. So literally, if you look at the design features of how they're doing it, you know, the planning of people spending 2 hours or more at the airport, you know, it was anticipated in 1990 that would go into effect, you know, 10 or 12 years later.
Wow. They knew it was coming.
Right. I'm telling you, well, I was a member of the team, and one of the things I know, we're talking about an establishment that is excellent at planning and planning ahead.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, and they plan in 100-year increments. I'll never forget, I was on a plane, when I was on Wall Street, I was flying out with a partner to, it was either to Chicago, Detroit, to the Middle East, to the Midwest, to on an energy deal. It was a private placement. We're working on the documents. And the plane hit an air pocket and went into a steep dive. And the stewardess just happened to be right next to our seats and let out a scream, screaming, "We're all going to die." Cool. Now, I learned later that it was her first day on the job. So so I realized, so she screams, "We're all going to die." And the first thing that came into my mind is, I need a plan. And then the second thing that came into my mind was, I don't think a plan can help because there's no way out.
Oh, no.
And the third thing that came into my mind is, well, you know, where's the positive in this? And then I realized, oh, I'm going to see all the people who I love who've died. And, you know, and then the plane righted itself right before we hit the ground.
Oh, thank God.
It was very gratifying.
Wow.
And it was really funny because the partner I was with, he was an amazing guy. He had very great powers of concentration. Throughout the whole dive, he kept working on the private placement memorandum because one of the things he knew is if we made it, he would still be responsible to get the deal done, you know, if we didn't crash. So
that's awesome.
But all I can tell you is the American establishment are planners and they're good at it and they plan way ahead.
Well, it's fascinating. You mentioned the thing about the airport, and I'll keep this short, but basically I tracked down this story about a woman who took over security at Logan Airport in the summer before. You probably know this story. And one of the things that they had planned to have in place in May was a massive camera security system, which they had no camera security system, and that was the May of 2001. And so she had all this stuff in place, and when she went through these basic channels who were going to do it, they kept saying, oh, there's a problem, you know, we need more time, there's a problem, we need more time, there's a problem, we need more time. And then afterwards, the fact, she's like, you know, it's incredible, we had this thing all lined up, and after 9/11 happens, you know, of course, there would have been pictures of those people boarding the planes, if they were those people, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, as it turned out, because they never got their act together, there were no security cameras, no pictures of the terrorists entering the planes, right. Or else that would have been a very different operation.
It's really interesting. You know, I in the money world, if you go around and all the times that you are stopped from you're not allowed to let things run right. And one of the things I'll tell you, if you look at the senior civil service in the United States, in my experience, they're phenomenally excellent managers. They're really, really good. Mm-hmm. And of course, everything's blamed on incompetence. Well, incompetence is a cover story. I mean, truly, it's a cover story. And if you go around and see where incompetence is required and enforced, that's when you understand how the real system works.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So you can understand the real system, but you have to get down in the trenches and look at how incompetence is engineered as a cover story.
Wow.
Right. It's like, oh, we can't. The system is too, it's delayed. It's this, it's that. There's a this, that.
Oh, that crazy government. They can't get their act together.
Oh, yeah. It's the stupid bureaucrats.
I told you I had a funny border story for you. There was a massive, the day after the Syria bombing, there was a massive UFO sighting on the Mexican border. I thought that was strange timing.
Really?
And pretty decent pictures of it, you know, about 12 right. different strange lights up there. I'll send you the image. It's pretty fascinating.
Okay, well, I just wonder how it related to the pressure being brought to bear on the president.
Oh, well, that's interesting, yeah. I don't think it was the night before, but that's a good question. I'll find out.
Right.
It was pretty heavy duty.
You know, one thing, just remember, you know, it's always good to do chronologies on events because it's, you know, through the money, there are connections that wouldn't be obvious. So one of the things to remember, on March 20th, David Rockefeller, the man who killed Kennedy, died.
The man in the background.
Okay. Power vacuum? Power vacuum?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The head of the Rockefeller dynasty dies on March 20th, and all of a sudden we see a new push to go to war with Rothschild allegedly reported in the City of London of saying, you know, I call on all civilized countries to basically engineer regime change in Syria.
Wow. Oh, it's an excellent point. You know, I watched your Twitter feed religiously, and you had a great one there with the whole Rothschild thing saying, well, you know, Assad basically wants to destroy our values or something along that line. And you saying, what values are those?
Right. So, yeah, but I think if you're Rothschild, you really don't, this is my guess, you really don't see how to evolve the model without war. Mm-hmm. And that's a bad place to be. And I think the challenge for all of us, you know, I wish we could all go in the invention room, is how do we find a pathway that doesn't involve World War III? That's what we've got to do. And right now, the national security state in the United States has just gotten more and more expensive and unproductive, more and more expensive and unproductive. You know, we've had 50 years of cost plus, more and more expensive, unproductive, and it's unbearable. I mean, the waste is unbearable, Daniel. And so we've got to figure out a way to create that pathway, because you know it's there. It's absolutely there. But if I was in Rothschild's shoes, I'd be scared to death. So in a funny kind of way, I empathize with him. I don't understand what his obligations are to produce funding for overhead and dividends. And that's the risk issue that I wish we could understand and could unleash our figuring out and finding a pathway. I don't want a nuclear war.
Yes, and this is the great danger that we face. If we fall asleep at the wheel and let these forces make the future for us.
Yeah.
You know, I believe Eisenhower saw this thing developing
and
gave that extraordinary speech as his farewell address. And what makes this so unusual is, you know, presidents could be expected to end their terms talking about their lofty achievements in foreign policy and domestically. Instead, here he's saying, guard against the military-industrial complex, quite extraordinary. as were some of Kennedy's speeches also along this line. But I think Eisenhower really made the kind of stand right there in his farewell address.
Eisenhower was a great man. Go back and watch Sputnik Fever and watch him best the Shriekometer. He repeatedly bested the spooky guys in the Shriekometer. You know my favorite Eisenhower story where he threatens to invade Area 51 with the First Army?
Yeah, this is just fascinating because it comes from a whistleblower who was around in that period in the military. And he basically talks about Eisenhower's relationship with the people in Area 51. So why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, the CIA, this is a great story. And I think Dolan at one point got one of the whistleblowers to tell the story on video.
Yes, that's right.
He created the executive order that created the Area 51 and authorized the CIA to provide security, which ended up making the CIA, the banker for the hidden finance system. Anyway, and then the CIA stopped keeping him briefed and reporting to him, and he got very irritated and finally called them one day and said if they were not in his office with a full briefing the next morning, he was going to fly to Colorado, get the First Army, and invade Area 51.
Huh.
And the reality, so they were in his office the next day and briefed him fully. And the reality was that Eisenhower had those relationships and leadership within the military that Kennedy didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And
it makes a big difference.
Right. And there's every indication that he fully briefed Kennedy. No, Kennedy had worked for Forrestal, who I believe was assassinated over all of this.
Oh, yeah.
So Kennedy was pretty knowledgeable, but Kennedy did not have that support and backing in the military. And Kennedy, of course, ended up with the American establishment replacing him.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they removed Kennedy by assassinating him because he basically understood what was behind the secrecy. You know, he certainly knew a lot about the UFO phenomena and that whole question. Now, I actually had Jim Mars on the show a while back, and he was talking about JFK being briefed about UFO crashes in New Mexico as early as 1947. And there are records to this effect. So I'm sure there are a number of factors that were involved in the motivation for his murder. But, you know, Douglas Caddy, who was the Watergate lawyer and best friends with the CIA's E. Howard Hunt, he told me that Hunt told him, and this is available if you're a subscriber, this episode is here, but Hunt told him that Kennedy was assassinated because he wanted to share information about the alien presence. Now, that's a quote. And so I think that this tells us a lot about the power struggle and what it really is all about. But certainly there is that shadowy financial network, and that's where Rockefeller comes in.
And that's why I think David Talbot's book, The Devil's Chessboard, in my opinion, is the single best book ever written about the Kennedy assassination. And he absolutely nails it, going from Dulles's project manager through Dillon as Secretary of Treasury, right into the Rockefellers and the Rockefeller Foundation board. So, mm-hmm. When I say David Wright, if there was any one person who led the assassination, it was David Rockefeller, in my opinion, based on Talbot's research. It's an incredible book.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing book. And we knew it was going to be good because Talbot wrote Brothers before that, which was about Robert Kennedy's pursuing the investigation behind the scenes into his brother's murder.
Right.
And that was a well-detailed account. But this book is even a step up from that. And we get to really look at CIA Director Alan Dulles.
It's such a remarkable book in terms of research, in terms of understanding, and taking the time to really understand the people. And he weaves in all of the financial and policy issues in a remarkable way. And so you really understand the fact that you have the central banking warfare model, and by Kennedy wanting to change it, he's hiccuping everybody throughout the ecosystem. Same exact issue that Trump is dealing with. Now, what Trump has tried to do is get into his cabinet people from all the different parts, and listen to them. So you see the Wall Street Journal yesterday saying the thing that engineered Trump's switch on Syria was the business community. In a sense, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
It's the financial interest saying we can't get from here to there. But what ultimately we're all going to have to grapple with, if you look at the system that we have, the model that we have, the central banking warfare model is not economic. And you can keep it going with more force for a little bit longer, but it's never going to work unless you do massive depopulation. So, you know, we're going to have to change or else we're going to paint ourselves into a corner. And we are now at the point, as I described in the annual wrap-up, where we're at a runway. These issues are going to get faced one way or another. So it's back to my old favorite line from Tina Turner. We can do this nice or rough.
Right, right.
So for 20 years, I've been trying to propose nice, but we're at a runway. So now we're into rough.
Wow. Well, I definitely agree with that. And Catherine, this has just been great. It's an incredible three-part interview series, having you here to help us see what's really happening behind the scenes. And I just have a couple of final questions for you.
Okay.
Now, Jane Mayer wrote a book recently called Dark Money, Tracking Billionaire Influence in Politics Behind the Scenes. You did a review of this book, which was very interesting. Can you tell us about it here?
Yeah, I was very interested in it because I wanted to – I've been looking for good sources to sort of understand the Koch brothers, what they're about, you know, why everybody's so angry. And Mayer is a very talented writer. It's a beautifully written book, and she has done incredible research. The challenge with the book, and there's a lot of very useful, helpful information, but you don't get a clear picture of what's going on because it's so overlaid with sort of progressives are good people and conservatives are bad people. And the ideology is confusing because if you listen to what she's saying about people's behavior, nobody's following their ideology anyway.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, everybody's just like for themselves or, you know, and then the progressives are for let's have more rules and more rules and more rules. And, we, you know, it's like, forget it. You know, you can't have an economy. If you listen to sort of her implication, let's destroy and shut down the entire economy. So the ideology is so sort of muddled and confused that it's hard to figure out what's really going on. But there's a lot of good information in it. And it's part of why, you know, I would love to see everybody have a very clear map of the economics of our situation. It's why, you know, I was building the software tool community wizard that would do software. It would let you see how the money worked within the world that you walked around and saw.
Mm-hmm.
And our problem is if you look at the financial ecosystem of our county, there are 3,100 counties in America. If you look at the ecosystem of our county, it's not being optimized. And I think if every citizen had those numbers and could bicker and argue without all this abstract ideology and get down to, okay, how are we going to optimize resources? And what are the fundamental principles that we really value and need to be reflected, i.e. a human civilization? How would the money work? It's interesting. I used to be on a great listserv for the Institute of Civic Values, and there was this guy who was a community developer, community organizer in Ohio, and he and I disagreed ideologically on everything. You know, I was the conservative Republican, and he was the Democrat socialist, and I believed in markets, and he believed in rules, and we were like, you know, whenever we discussed ideology, it was complete war. Anytime you pulled out a neighborhood and you pulled out the money, we agreed down the line on everything.
Amazing.
Because we both wanted to optimize people's time and money, and we both wanted a human civilization. So when it got down to the time and money of a neighborhood, we were like, you know, the two most powerful allies in the world. We agreed totally on everything. It's amazing.
Wow.
Well, that's why you have to decentralize. Because the people who want an honest civilization are going to agree most of the time. It's very interesting. One of my favorite congresspeople is Marcy Kaptur from Toledo.
Yeah.
She is fantastic, unbelievable woman. And I'm a huge Marcy Kaptur fan. And I was in Ohio for another reason, and I wanted to do a fundraiser for Marcy Kaptur. And she came up to speak, and I had this great subscriber who's a committed Republican, you know, and he's like, Marcy Kaptur is a Democrat and a socialist. And I said, Marcy Kaptur believes in managing the money according to the law. And that's what you need. And that's what you want. And I said, I want you to just listen. And he came and listened to Marcy Kaptur. And he said, she's fantastic. I'm giving a huge donation. Because what he heard was somebody talking about, let's obey the law when it comes to how we manage the money.
Well, it's an excellent point.
You know?
Yeah, it's just, if you...
Right.
I was just going to say the Sanders people, for example, and the Ron Paul people are very different in terms of their ideology, but they both have the desire for transparency in common.
Right. If you got all the Ron Paul people and all the Sanders people together in a neighborhood arguing, there's a process called participatory budgeting. If you got them all in the same neighborhood discussing participatory budgeting and what we're going to do in the money, they're going to agree.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get a huge... Now, you know, their disagreements will be fun to listen to, but they're going to invent together. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And things are going to work because they both, you know, they both share a distaste for criminal enterprise and providing subsidy to finance other civilizations secretly.
Right.
That's what they share. So I think you're going to see one of the things that's going to come out of whatever is happening in Washington is a renewed interest in getting to the table locally and making sure things work locally.
Well, you said the magic word there, which is my last question. Now, we've touched on the annual wrap-up Solari report in part one, which is incredible, and the possible scenarios that you created for our future in there. It's great information, but something that caught my attention was that you decided to emphasize food in this report.
Right.
Now, certainly, there's a lot of information in there about GMOs versus healthy organic food and how there are incredible investment opportunities in the food arena, along with lists of different companies that you provided that have room to grow. Now, why did you decide on food as the main focus of this Solari report?
So here's why food is so important. When globalization was working, you know, the Anglo-American Alliance is a huge food export juggernaut. But while globalization was working, nobody had to worry about, is my country, is my county a food importer or exporter? Because food is abundant. Now, there are real quality issues in the United States, as we've discussed with GMOs and other things, but let's put that for aside. If you look at food as a percentage of the family budget or the volatility of the prices, food is off many people's radar screen because most of us have lived in places where food was abundant. Okay?
Okay.
If globalization breaks down, it's going to matter. Are you in a country where they have food and water? Are you a food and water importer? Okay? It's going to matter tremendously for political power and financial power. The other reason I wanted to do it was not just sort of the if globalization breaks down, but the other thing is I think that food as a percent of the family budget is going to start to rise.
Mm-hmm.
And so access to high quality food and the economics of how you get food, I think are going to be steadily rising in importance, both to the family, household, and budget, but also to investors. As an investor in a low-yield environment, where are the companies that have an inelastic demand for their service or their product that can support steady dividends?
Hmm.
And so one of my questions, traditionally investing in food hasn't been a very, you know, interesting thing. And part of it is food is spread around into different asset categories. It's never been its own asset category like real estate. But and it's one of the reasons I broke out the stocks and sort of showed how it's spread across different asset categories. But you'll notice I had an ETF in there that's called Rising Food Prices, and it's done very, very well recently. And I think that's because households are struggling with inflation, but their demand for food is inelastic. And so I'm very curious to see what the economics are of food. There was one other thing. If, you know, we have managed the agriculture in the United States, Daniel, to be part of this Anglo-American Alliance export juggernaut and to really help project our power globally.
Right.
If we should pull the agricultural subsidies from the budget, then it's going to fundamentally change the economics of every farmer in America. Do you farm for the local market or do you farm for the export market? It's going to start making local much more attractive. Now, one of the reasons that's of interest to me is if we're going to create jobs, if robotics is going to push a lot of people out of the workforce, it's very easy. the way to create jobs, and that is to pull down a lot of the barriers the government has created to building local farms and local food markets. And with food getting more expensive, boy, it's going to make that, it's going to change the economics of that. So I foresee the potential for big changes in the fundamental economics of food and the fundamental politics of food, both at the macro level and the micro level. It intrigues me. I wanted to understand it better, which is why I did this. And it was a way of saying to you as a manager of a family budget or you as a participant in the global financial markets looking at sovereign credits, saying, hey, you know, this has always been on remote control and you didn't have to worry about it. But you know something, this may come off of remote control. You may have to worry about it and it may all change.
Huh.
So take a look and think about this because there are risks and opportunities here if we go through change on food.
Fascinating. Well, it's such a fundamental core component to any healthy society.
Yeah.
And to think that we're kind of, you know, out of touch with this and...
Spoiled. We're spoiled.
Yeah.
We're spoiled.
Yeah,
I'm spoiled. I'm spoiled.
Well, you made a great point about GMOs too, which is that you can get very different societies and people if you're a synthetic, you know, GMO people versus a healthy, nutritional, organic people in society.
Well, we've been doing, on the Salieri Report, we've been doing something called the Food Series with Harry Blaser, who I consider the top consultant in the world, most knowledgeable person on food that I've ever met. Amazing, amazing person. He built the largest fresh food market in the country and then sold it to Whole Foods. And since then, he's a consultant working for food companies all over the world. And he just knows the, you know, the ins and outs and the backwards and forwards. So Harry's been doing a food series and he did an incredible series with Francois Vecchio, who really is really the top butcher in the world. And Vecchio pointed out right at the end of the interview, he said, in Europe, we pay twice as much a year for our food, but we pay half as much for healthcare. And he said, so you can pay for it in the front or you can pay it on the back. You know, it's your, and I would rather have wonderful food than,
you know, absolutely
catastrophic healthcare. So
I think the food thing is dramatic. And I think the more that things like urban farms and stuff pop up, and, you know, we see some movements like that. It's very light. There's a lot of regulations against it. You know, right. We see couples being fined for growing carrots in their front yard. I mean, you know.
Look, I'll be blunt. The food safety rules are 80% a conspiracy to stop the population from feeding itself with healthy food. I'll just be blunt.
Yeah.
Wow. I wouldn't have believed that 20 years ago, but now I've gone through the detail and food safety is very important, and it's important to have good food safety rules. So I'm not against food safety, but food safety was basically designed to centralize the agricultural industry in this country, and it's a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's talk about destroying productivity, unbelievable. But it's coming out in the healthcare system. I mean, that is if there is a phenomena driving up the healthcare prices, I would say that the results of destroying the local farm and the local food markets is doing more to contribute to high healthcare costs than anything else, even the pharmaceutical companies.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Amazing. This is an incredible report on the food aspects. And, you know, you really wrapped up the whole year in here, but it gives everyone that blueprint for 2017, what they can look for. And I think bringing food into the center of their consciousness is a great idea. So I'm really glad that you put that in there. And it's also kind of surprising. You know, a lot of people are thinking, well, you know, economics, you know, they have to come to realize when they deal with the work that you do at Salieri, you know, it's a wide tapestry of information that can really help them. And I always say it's Salieri University. That's the way I look at it.
Well, here's what I'm interested in. If you take a family, you know, let's take two parents, two kids, some grandparents, some siblings, you know, some related family and some neighbors. That's who I'm thinking about. And my question is, how can they use their time and money to have a free and inspired life? So my goal for my subscribers is they have a great life. What is the information they need to protect themselves from being harvested and to protect themselves from being harmed? And what is the information they need to really build both health and wealth? That's what I care about. And if you look at their income statement balance sheet and all the different things they're grappling with, you know, the reason my scope is so wide is they have to deal with everything. If you're a family of four trying to build retirement savings and make sure your kids are safe, you know, you have to deal with it all, the fact that they're spraying heavy metals on your head.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, they're trying to give your kids vaccine or kick them out of school if you don't poison them with vaccines. And, you know, but meantime, you're having to deal with, do I put my money in the equity markets or fixed income, or do I buy real estate? Do I pay off my mortgage? You have to deal with a whole gamut of this. And you have to deal with it with, you know, fake news trying to persuade you to do things which are against your own interest. So part of the question is, how do you start to build a moat around your health and your money and you know, keep the system from harvesting or taking advantage of you? And then how do you proceed through all of that? You know, it's kind of like running a gauntlet. How do you proceed through all of that to really build a successful life?
You know, that is the central question.
Right.
Catherine, thank you so much. An amazing series here. And if people want more of your research and incredible analysis, it's at solari.com. That's where you can go. The Solari reports are informative and groundbreaking. They're always ahead of the trends, usually by, I would say, 2 years or more. And of course, you do the annual wrap-ups, but you also do the quarterly wrap-ups.
I do them quarterly. And again, the idea is, and we do them in PDFs and flipbooks. If you want to buy the hard copy, you've got to pay extra. It's not part of the subscription. And but we do them quarterly because I find if you're a really busy person, particularly if you've got kids, you know, you have the time to sit down four times a year and really stay current.
Right.
And that's my goal, is to make sure you stay current. And, you know, other than that, it's kind of hit or miss. So, and it's very important to take that time to stay current, but you need to do it in a way that keeps you coherent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of information coming in from both corporate and independent media designed to turn you into incoherent. And no one makes good decisions from a state of incoherent. You've got to stay coherent. So that's my goal, is to keep you current and get you focused on the bigger questions, the deeper issues, and do it from a place of coherency.
Excellent. Well, I've learned so much through your work, as have thousands of others. So we're going to have you back on in the summer to see what's going on then. Incredible information. Catherine Austin Fitz, Solari.com. Thank you.
Take care of yourself.
Thank you. You too, Catherine.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode with former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz on A Tale of Two Civilizations. Subscribers can look forward to a month of upcoming episodes from Dr. Joseph Farrell, Dr. Nick Begich, and Elena Freeland on the Space Fence program. You don't want to miss it. See you soon.
We want to hear from you. To let us know what's on your mind, you can email us at info@darkjournalist.com. Dark Journalist. Go for truth in 2017. The deepest questions, the biggest secrets, the darkest mysteries. Dark Journalist. Go for truth. With top guests like Graham Hancock.
Graham, how do we as a society escape the grip of the deep state in the 21st century?
Rather than spending trillions of dollars every year on building up our armies and our weapons of mass destruction and creating a climate of hatred and fear and suspicion, we should be uniting as a human race.
Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, what is the issue that's holding us back and destroying prosperity?
We have a system which has got a negative return on investment. It's killing human productivity. and where it's going is inhuman.
Dark Journalist. Go for truth. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special summer discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll receive exclusive member benefits, including access to the complete high-quality audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, and subscriber-only content, including bonus show material. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist. This is the year. Now is the time.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Join us now and go for truth.